This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
We never chose to be public figures or to take on this fight, but we also never thought we could be arrested this way. We're glad not only that this ruling lets us get on with our lives, but that it opens the door for gay people all across the country to be treated equally.
John G. Lawrence speaking Thursday in Houston. Mr. Lawrence and Tyrone Garner were the plaintiffs in a case that made history this week. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Texas anti-sodomy law. 12 other states have similar laws. The court saved some of its most controversial decisions for this last week in the session, also ruling in support of affirmative action in college admissions. NPR's senior news analyst Dan Shore joins us. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Scott.
And let's turn first to the court's reversal on anti-sodomy laws.
Yes.
In 1986, the court upheld such laws in Bowers v. Hardwick.
Mm-hmm.
But you inescapably noted even this week that even the dissenters, the three dissenters to this opinion, and I'm going to quote from Justice Thomas. Justice Clarence Thomas said he thought the anti-sodomy laws were, quote, silly.
Mm-hmm.
How much of a change might this portend for the United States?
Well, I think it's a big change for the United States. It clearly is a great victory for gay rights in this country. It may lay the groundwork for other such victories, like accepting the idea of gay marriages, which Canada has done. But beyond this is the apparent willingness of the court to take on some of the burning, hot-button cultural and social issues of America today. One would not have expected the judiciary to step in where the legislature and the executive sometimes fear to tread, but there you are. That's what they've done. They've expanded the definition of privacy, and you sit there with your mouth dropped.
Well, forgive me. Let me also ask about the decision in support of affirmative action in university admissions, although also including some guidelines that could limit it. I want to ask you about Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's majority opinion, in which she suggested this matter of affirmative action might be a debate that will be moot in the next 25 years.
Well, if as much progress is made in the next 25 years as has been made in the last 25 years in establishing equality in this country, then she may very well turn out to be right. The fact of the matter is that 25 years ago we could talk about specific minorities. Today there are more Hispanics than there are blacks, and may not be very long before the Caucasians in this country are considered to be a minority. And so anything which moves towards equality of treatment clearly is something which can happen in a quarter century.
Do you see any kind of ideological shift or trace that you can make of this week's rulings on the court?
Well, I'll tell you, remember, I think it was Will Rogers. I've tried to look it up and haven't succeeded in finding it. I think it was Will Rogers who said that the court follows the election returns, right? As a matter of come to think of it, the last presidential election, the court made the election returns. But that is another matter for some other time. They are willing to take on abortion, which they have done and sustained in spite of many, many predictions that they were going to go back on abortion. They've taken gay rights. They've taken affirmative action. These are all issues in which the court seems to have shifted, not so much for ideological reasons among the justices, but more because the court seeks to reflect the temper of the country today. People believe in liberty. People believe in privacy. They want the controversy over these rights to simply go away. They want things to work all right. It's interesting that what effect this may have, however, on the makeup of the court. If Justice William Rehnquist retires, as have been many rumors, but I'm not sure it's true, but if he retires, you would expect that next in line to be Chief Justice would be Sandra Day O'Connor. That would make it possible to say that if President Reagan appointed the first woman, that President Bush appointed the first woman Chief Justice. However, with the positions that she's lately taken, I imagine she's ruffled some conservative feathers, and that then may become a little more difficult.
Let me ask you to turn your eyes to Capitol Hill. The House and Senate have both passed versions of a Medicare bill, and they're versions that seem to be different from each other. What do you make about these dueling Medicare bills?
Well, Congress, and especially the House of Representatives, are torn between the wish to spend about $400 billion taking the whole Medicare prescription drug issue away from the Democrats. But then there is a conservative repugnance to expanding a federal program. And these things tend to run into each other with the result that you get extremely complicated legislation, complicated on both sides and complicated as between them. And you get a series of contradictory impulses with the Republicans trying to channel the money through private companies and in order to say they were not expanding the reach of Medicare. You may wonder why it is that this has become an issue so many years after Medicare started, which was in 1966.
Well, you covered that then. And I want to ask you about the difference in prominence that the question of prescription drugs plays today as it did in 1966.
That's very interesting. I myself sat and talked to my wife about it, who knew a lot about it because she helped to design the Medicare program. Mm-hmm. I said, you remember when we first did the announcement of Medicare starting July 1st, 1966 with an interview with Bob Ball, the Social Security Commissioner, we didn't talk about drugs at all. How come? And the answer to that is that out-of-hospital drug costs were at that time a very incidental expense, not worth talking about. Before a lot of great new miracle drugs, but very expensive miracle drugs, today we have an issue which simply wasn't there 30 years ago, but it's there today.
Expensive issue.
Very expensive issues, indeed.
Let me ask you now, turn to the news abroad. Israeli security officials have agreed to pull back from the Gaza Strip in Bethlehem and let Palestinian forces try and secure the area. Islamic Jihad, we learned this morning, has joined Hamas in agreeing to a ceasefire. How promising or real are these developments?
Well, compared to the situation of the past couple of years with this constant tit-for-tat violence, you could say that any change is promising. The truce is supposed to last for about 3 months, and if there could be a few more confidence-building measures, like an idea which is being floated now of joint Palestinian and Israeli police patrols, something good could then come out of it. But, you know, Middle East is somewhere where whenever you want to say something hopeful, you cross your fingers before you do it. It's a time for a little hope today and some crossed fingers.
Almost every day in Iraq, there is violence directed against U.S. and British soldiers. And more recently, we also were learning Iraqi civilians who are trying to help in the administration and reconstruction. Do you see a pattern of organization in this resistance?
Well, the military says that there is no guerrilla war going on. And their question is, what do you mean by organization? Organization, I mean you can be organized without being centralized. There is not yet any sign of a centralized guerrilla war, although they've unearthed some plans of Iraqi intelligence way back then for a campaign of sabotage in case of occupation. It does look as though something's there which is more than sniping by this person or by that person. And I think that the military are going to face the fact that the war, in spite of what the president said on the 1st of May on the deck of the Abraham Lincoln, the war in Iraq just isn't quite over.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our senior news analyst, Dan Shore.